listening to the Ascend Podcast, where college and university leaders, thinkers, and innovators come to learn practical and proven strategies for improving retention rates, graduation rates, and overall student success. Are you ready?
Let's go.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ascend Podcast. I am Eric Kirby, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Jared Tippetts. Dr. Tippetts, good to be with you today.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Good to see you this week.
Hey, so Jared, regular listeners of the Ascend Podcast know that each week we release what we call a short session, where we'll share one idea, strategy, or initiative for improving retention and student success efforts, which come from our book, Ascend to Higher Retention Rates. The other type of episodes we release are what we call our expert session podcasts, where we will interview student success experts from across the country to capture their best thinking on the subject. So today's episode is going to be one of our expert sessions, and I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. It's unique in that we get three experts with us today. So Jared, why don't you do us the honors and introduce our special guests?
Hey, thanks, Eric. I am really excited for today's conversation as well. We have been joined by three amazing leaders from National University. We've been joined by Dr. Mark Milliron, who is their president and CEO. Mark, good to see you today.
Good to see you, Jared.
We've also been joined by Angela Baldessari, who is the Deputy Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategic Institutional Research and Planning. Angela, good to see you today.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you too.
As well as Sarah Ball, who is their AVP over their learner experience. Sarah, good to be with you.
Thanks for having me, Jared.
All right, you three, you've all had very interesting careers to get to where you are today. So let's start by taking a minute and having you tell us a little bit more about your career path and how you got connected to this important work of helping students achieve their educational goals and dreams. And so, Mark, we'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about your background.
I have a wonderfully complex and pretty rowdy background coming into this work. I've done 30 plus years of what I would call access, success, and equity work in the world of education. I come from a first generation background. I was one of nine kids who barely got into higher ed. Thank God for a community college at Mesa Community College in Arizona. Really, the people there helped change my life, got me on a different pathway to possibility. Got my way through to Arizona State, graduated summa cum laude, graduated there also with my master's degree, then went and got my doctorate at UT Austin. Fell in love with education as a pathway to possibility for first generation and low income students and diverse students in particular, and devoted my career to it. So I've had the blessing of working in traditional education, in the nonprofit world, in the foundation world, in the corporate world. But the red thread out of all the positions, whether it was with the Gates Foundation or with Oracle or SAS or with Western Governors University or UT Austin, the red thread has always been, how do we help more and more diverse students be more successful than ever before? So coming to National was a complete natural because National University was built for this purpose. It was specifically to help non-traditional working and military students have more access to opportunity through education than ever before, from associates through PhDs and law degrees. So it feels like home.
Great. Yeah. What a cool experience that's led you to where you are today. Very good. All right, Angela, tell us a little bit about your career.
All right. So my career started off with me being a faculty member in sociology. And it didn't take long for me to realize, come to grips with the fact that my passion for sociology really was all about my passion for solving social problems, in particular questions of social inequality. And so I left academia as a faculty member, really wanting to be able to do more practical hands-on work with the problems that I wanted to grapple with. And so I left and I headed into the government and nonprofit sector. I spent about 6 years there working with state governments, small governments, community-based organizations, helping them tackle problems, helping them secure the funding to tackle those problems, to implement their solutions and their strategies, and to demonstrate the outcomes of their work so that they could continue to garner funding. And after that time, I returned to higher ed, this time on the administrative side at the University of Arizona, where I spent nearly a decade building assessment and research for student affairs and enrollment management, really doing all of that work on a very local and specific scale at the university, and then ultimately running institutional research there and being part of the key strategy team on our data and how that informed student success. after leaving the University of Arizona, I had the privilege, and I think this was a real turning point in my career, of going into consulting, first at in ed tech, at Civitas Learning, where I met Mark, and then subsequently on my own. And during those years, I had the invaluable exposure to the whole of higher education landscape, where I worked with schools that were 2 years, 4 years, for-profits, not-for-profits, online institutions, and public and private. And I really got my education there about the different types of students that are served, the different business models for doing so, the different strategies employed for student success, what works, what doesn't. And much like Mark, you know, as a first generation student, I had, you know, largely flagship state institution career in higher ed until that time. And that experience in consulting really opened my eyes, and I fell in love also with the community college sector, with the adult education space, and just the transformative opportunities that are there in that part of the market. And so I've been at National now for 1 year. I see it as the culmination of all of those experiences to date. And I've really had ultimately a career as a translator of data into practice, and it's my honor to be here today.
Wow. What a rich set of experiences to bring you where you are today. That's great. Thank you. All right, Sarah, tell us a little bit about your background. Your turn.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. So I actually started my career in academic medicine. I have a degree in healthcare administration and a master's degree, and always was really passionate about the interconnectivity between your personal health, the healthcare system, and the experience and interplay between those two entities. And so I worked at Cincinnati Children's, and I was their fellow in strategy and really understanding those intricate experiences and those moments that matter for patients and families. And then came to Pittsburgh and did very similar work on the operational side. And then we had the opportunity to kind of translate that operational work to very focused experience work. And that started off really just as everyone thinks about surveys and experience. You know, how is your experience? Please rate it from a 9 to a 10. And then follow up with the comments that were handwritten. And really took that ecosystem over the course of a decade to really meaningful strategy improvement, really understanding the intricacies, the personalization that experience can bring to the landscape. And now that can improve that child's health, that family health, the community health, and how that really does parlay that into really just great forward steps in as a community. And I love my work at UPMC Children's. It was just a great team. And just really, quite frankly, on a whim, I saw a really unique ad about student experience. And I thought to myself, I wonder if we can parlay the ecosystem that we have for healthcare into education to better understand how do learners experience their learning, how do they experience the process of education, and how can we improve that ecosystem? And I feel very fortunate that I was selected to be part of the national team to start that work. And I have started doing that. So how do we live beyond the student experience survey bubble and really proliferate that into an ecosystem to really ensure that every student every day feels the national mission, vision, and values that we have here. And that is, I've been here for 3 years, and it's been an honor to really be part of the team.
So cool. I always find it fascinating how people end up where they do. And y'all have had very unique paths in getting to where you are, but we appreciate you being here, and thanks for sharing that with us. All right, let's start in some additional questions. And President Milliron, we'll start with you. Share with us a little bit about National University to help provide some context to our listeners for the conversation today.
Yeah, National University is a university based in San Diego, but operates in all 50 states. We actually have students in about 20 countries because of the profile of the students we serve, typically heavy military. So we were founded in 1971 by a Navy captain, Dr. David Chigos, who was pretty distressed at seeing a lot of his sailors and fellow service members not being well served by traditional education. They were trying to use their GI Bills and they just couldn't get courses that made sense for them, schedules that made sense for them, and even just basic accommodations given their deployments or given their work kind of working situations. And he kind of said, okay, we love our traditionals. It's great they're doing what they're doing, but we actually need a model that actually meets the needs of military working and non-traditional students in a really high quality way. And that was the founding of National University. And fast forward 52 years, and you're looking at a university that has helped 240,000 folks achieve degrees, bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degrees. We have 50,000 credit students, about 80,000 non-credit workforce development students in all 50 states, heavy in California, obviously. About half of our undergrads are MilVet. They're either active duty veterans or dependents. So still very true to that kind of mission of the military in particular. We have a really strong graduate school. Our graduate school is over 50% of our student population. And I think we're the largest producer of graduate degrees to diverse students in the country. We're number three for doctoral degrees. We are particularly strong in everything from cybersecurity to psychology. One of the biggest producers of BIPOC PsyDs in the country by far. We're incredibly strong in teaching. We're the number one teaching trainer in the state, you know, teaching provider in the state of California. Really strong transfer agreements with community colleges all over the country. We work deeply in partnership with them because of those folks. But, you know, we're a different kind of student population, average age of 33. But that ranges. If you come to our commencements, you'll see people as young as 18 cross the stage and as seasoned as 78. And you're just as likely to see kids cheering for mom and dad getting their degrees as you are to see parents cheering for their kids. So it's a very different kind of university. We know who we are. We know who we serve. Almost all of our students are working. They fit either the non-traditional working or military profiles. We embrace it. We love it. And we show that you can do that at every level, the associates, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral level. And we embrace this frame of using next generation education, which is whatever tool, technology, policy, or practice can help students learn more deeply and be more effective. We wrap that in whole human education, which is the right kind of supports at the right time for the right students. And our theories, basically, if you take next generation education wrapped in whole human education, which is really understanding and caring for who that student is, and you combine those things and aim it at what we call value-rich education, which is we don't just want students to complete. Of course, we want them to complete. We want them to suck the marrow out of this experience. We want them to get everything out of this educational experience. So value-rich education for us is we want them to have a credential-rich pathway where they can optimize the family of post-secondary credentials, certifications, badges, along with their degrees. We want them to have connection-rich education where they meet all kinds of other faculty members, students, and professionals in their space. Those connections are often the deepest and richest part of the educational experience, by the way, Sarah will tell you. And then you'll also hear us talk about experience rich, where we want these students to, whether it's their clinical experience, their parapro experience, it's their internship, whatever it is, we want them to have a family of experiences that help them have a deep, rich experience at National, because this is a transformative time for them. So National is a special place. We have a good sense of who we are. We do research focused on the student population we care about all the way through kind of open access, kind of open doors at the front door to kind of pull folks in. We would consider ourselves in the class of access, success, and equity innovators on the national stage. And I think for us, it's just it's hard work, but it's good work.
Yeah, so cool to learn more about what you're doing there. Just for our listeners' sake, tell us a little bit more about the breakdown between students who you would consider traditionally face-to-face versus online students.
So we're about 65% purely online and about 35% on-ground or hybrid. So, and that obviously the pandemic accelerated that. We were about 50-50 before the pandemic, and post-pandemic we're about 65-35. We do, however, have a really interesting play we're engaging in right now, which is we actually are hearing from our students, and this is a student experiences thing. We're hearing from them that they don't necessarily want to go to a class. They still like the flexible online learning, the asynchronous learning, the 4-week courses, the 8-week courses, but they would love to have a place for their learning, because often they don't have a safe place to learn. They don't have high-speed internet. They don't have a quiet place to learn. And so we're actually starting to partner with community colleges, and we're developing this concept called the Nucleus Center. And the Nucleus Center, NU, right, is a center. Think about it, instead of a WeWork site, it's a WeLearn site where a student can come in and they can have comfortable couches, tables, high-speed internet, just-in-time tutoring and support if they need it. But we also are partnering with the Y to provide childcare. So they can drop off their kid and then come. And, you know, 65% of our learners are working women. So you better have solutions for childcare if you're going to be serious about this. So we're pretty excited. We'll do our flagship nucleus. We'll be at our Spectrum Library. We're actually converting our entire library into a nucleus center in partnership with the YMCA. And then the next set will all be with like Southwestern College, San Diego. And we're talking to the Maricopa Community Colleges about doing one there. We're pretty excited about this idea. The learners have told us having this kind of a third place will be, it's, you know, important for them. It's not for every learner, but for a big chunk of learners, this will become kind of their home away from home.
Yeah, I love that, right? Like you talked about, this kind of idea of next generation education and the whole human education, which results in that value-rich education. I just love what you're doing there and the creativity with which you're approaching how to support every student, regardless of where they are and whatever experience they're having in life.
That's also why you need tough-minded, like rock star people like Angela and Sarah on the team, because they're the ones who will help you figure out, because this is not simple. Traditional education has a playbook. And when you break that playbook and you do things differently, you have to make sure you're doing it in a high quality way, but you also have to do it in a way that really helps the student, but also you can translate it to your regulators, to your creditors, to other kind of folks and help them understand how that plays out. And that's why having really sharp folks on the team like Angela and Sarah really matter.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, Angela, so how do you define student success there at National University? What does that look like to you? You know, in addition to just crossing the stage to get a degree, how are you all defining it?
That's a great question. So for us, delivering on student success is delivering on our students' goal attainment, how they define it, right? And as Mark described our student population, it's incredibly diverse. It's students of all ages with all different levels of experience with higher education in their back pocket. And we call them anders, right? These are students and. They are students and employees. They are students in active duty military or veteran. They are students and parents and family members, caretakers. And so these are busy people. And they come to us for all kinds of reasons. And we need to deliver on the reasons that they came to National. And so whether that be a complete degree, whether that be a certificate or a credential or some stackables, or whether that be just a class or two, we need to meet students where they are and help them meet the goals that they've set for themselves. That means understanding those goals and being prepared to meet them and providing them with the right on and off ramps to do that. And I think what it also means is not only do they succeed and complete whatever credential that they come to us for, it's that they experience value at each and every step of the way. And that value-rich education, I'll underscore that, that's critical to us. It's also critical in the literature, especially on adult learners. One of the differentiators between a traditional age student population and the adult learner population is the focus on utility as part of success for students. And, you know, adult learners really are looking at utility, or AKA value, in every experience, whether it's what am I learning in this general education course that's relevant to what I'm doing in my job or what I hope to do with my career, what I hope to learn in my degree, versus what utility is there, what value do I get from my interactions with people at the institution, from the services that support me to the faculty that I'm engaged with and hope to learn from and have as mentors. And so we really are trying to stack that experience with value all along the way. And the meaningful learning opportunities are really key to that. So it has to be rich, meaningful learning, which is part of that whole next generation. So if they leave here achieving the goal that they had set for themselves, and hopefully more than that, that we encourage them to build on that for a lifetime of learning, and they feel cared for as a human being, and that they have gotten value all of the way. That's our definition of student success.
That's such a cool definition. It's got my head turning a little bit as far as finding value at every step of the way. I wonder how, you know, your traditional university, if it were to shift to that model and lens, how that could really start changing and impacting students. And I appreciate as well your efforts in letting students help define what success looks like, right? What it means to them, what their unique goals and purposes are. So kudos to you all. That's a really cool way to look at it. Sarah, let's jump to you. When you think about the future of retention, completion, student success, What are some things that you see coming that colleges, universities, institutions need to be thinking about in order to help more students find success?
Yeah, I will start by hooking right into what Angela said. This is a very personal journey. It allows you to, everybody comes to this educational table for a personal goal, a personal reason to advance who they are. And we are trying to really answer that call every day, every student, every time. But to do that, it really takes a personalized experience ecosystem to understand what are those moments that matter for Angela? What are those moments that matter for Mark? And how are they different? How are they the same? And how are we answering each one of those moments to ensure future success, retention, completion, but also that they're getting that value? You know, and I think understanding what that ecosystem is really what I think we're trying to do here at National. It's looking at those micro moments of success, those micro moments of friction, understanding the interplay and the personalization that can happen in that ecosystem, and then make tweaks. I think this is really an opportunity to look at all those moments stacked up together, but also in a continuous improvement cycle. It's not something that happens overnight. It's something that is built and improved over time. And as, you know, different generations come in to the educational system and the student journey, we need to have an ecosystem that is agile, right? And can meet each generation where they are, each student where they are. And so at National, what we've tried to do is create an ecosystem of experience that allows us to understand real time, what are those moments that matter? How, you know, where are they the same and where are they different? And how are we meeting that challenge, you know, in their learning, in their human support, in making sure they have a place to learn with the Nucleus Centers, but really be multifaceted as our students are in making sure that they are retaining what we need them to, not just in their coursework, but I think Angela really said makes a lot of sense, but are they getting that value? Can they translate that value from that current class to maybe where they're working today? And how are they going to build that in future job opportunities? How can we make it really relevant and exciting and a part of who they are and really make that partnership a success, not just for National, but for each student that we serve? And the ecosystem really allows us to do that. I think that's where universities are going to need to spend more of their time, is understanding what are the experiences and where are we really capturing that value and that human support, and where are there gaps and how do we continue to fill those gaps over time?
Yeah, I love that. You know, for a long time in higher education, and I'm oversimplifying it here, but to make the point that, you know, higher education really just consisted of going to campus, sitting in a classroom for 50 minutes for a number of weeks throughout the semester. And as an old a mentor of mine used to say, and you, like a squirrel, you once you collected 120 nuts, then you graduated, yeah. Right? And I love what you're talking about here about the entire ecosystem and searching for value across the whole experience and helping students achieve their goals and dreams. Higher education moving forward has to be so much more than collecting 120 nuts.
I think the expectations have changed. Yeah. The expectations of our students has changed. This is, you know, a very high ticket item for many families. This is a huge cost and they want the value on the top of that. And I think the ecosystem of understanding what that value is in those moments that matter to ensure that we're delivering on that commitment is part of the future.
Yeah. For many, this will be the second most expensive purchase, if you will, of their life. Maybe a home will be more, but for some universities around the country, it may be more than their house. Right. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Hey, Jared, I want to make sure we're clear about something. And we say this all the time at National. We do not like getting into better than conversations about other universities, because we actually think there are a group of 18 to 20 year olds who want on-campus experiences. And that's the value that they're looking for. And if we always say, if that's what you're looking for the love of God, don't come to National. That's not what we do, right? But later in your life, when you're a working adult and you want to get your master's or your doctorate and you need something flexible where you're working, that's us. That's what we do. So part of what we try to say is like, you got to understand what your mission is and who your audience is and who you're trying to serve. And is your model designed to actually add the most value for that student population? population as it makes sense. And I think part of the blessing for National is radical clarity. We know exactly who we're trying to serve and why we're trying to serve them. So many other universities are just, they're in almost a monkey mind where they're, you know, one over here, it's very traditional over here. They're trying to be non-traditional over here. They're doing it. And it's hard for them to kind of get to clarity about what they want to do and the way they want to do it. But I tell you, for some of the traditionals, like their purpose in life is to be a small independent university with that kind of transformative experience and small classrooms. And if that's what they want to do, God bless them, go do that and do that incredibly well. That's not what we're built for. And so I don't want to get into the better than conversations about models. It all depends on who you're serving and what value looks like for that student population. Because trust me, an 18-year-old who wants to be on campus and have that kind of experience, if they came to Nashville, would not find it a value-rich experience. They'd be frustrated.
Yeah, but I think the important takeaway there is, and you've said it multiple times so far in our time together, is that you know exactly who you are. And so many universities, like you just said, don't know exactly who they are. And partially it's because, you know, we're in this arms race of enrollments across the country, right? And so many institutions are trying to do everything they can to get as many enrollments as possible. And through that approach, oftentimes the value goes out the door, like you were saying. So I think that's a really important takeaway, though, for our listeners to help drive that conversation on their campus.
But I will say, I don't, and here's the problem. When you get into an enrollment arms race, there's two things to that don't make any sense to me. One, again, blessing for us is our population is not shrinking. I mean, there are 40 million adults with some college and no credential. Okay, we'll take 1%. You can have all the rest, right? There's plenty of work to do in that market. Not to mention, there's just more and more working adults who need education to be able to rise. So it is an open range for us to be able to kind of go pull those folks in. Second part of it is, like, I firmly believe our competition is not another university. My competition is not WGU, SNU, or somebody else. Our competition is poverty. Our competition is opportunity. Like, we're trying to make sure people have more opportunity than ever before. They have more power over their lives before. And that changes your mindset, because I'm not trying to beat ASU. I'm trying to open a pathway for the student, which changes our design principles, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, such good stuff. All right, let's shift gears here. So this is the Ascend podcast. Therefore, we got to spend some time talking about the Ascend model. And what we'd like to do is just pick your brains about how you're thinking about these unique concepts in the work that you do. And so, as a quick reminder to our listeners, Ascend is an acronym that stands for affordability, support, culture, engagement, nudges, and data. So let's dive into each of these concepts and chat about each of them. Mark, let's start with you and talk a little bit about affordability. How are you all thinking about affordability there at National University as it relates to helping more students complete and graduate and achieve their goals?
Yeah, a few ways. One is we're always trying to make sure we are keeping our tuition low. In fact, we're looking at some scheduling innovations right now in the coming year where we're going to move to more of a subscription model where students can load up over four, you know, they can still take 4-week courses and 8-week courses, but over 4 months they can bank courses and, you know, get a different kind of model, which will allow us to lower tuition a little bit, which will be great. So stay tuned for that. We're piloting that as we speak. The other thing is we've moved all of our aid to needs-based aid. And part of that is to make sure we're driving affordability for those who need it the most. And we're also really looking at more strategic packaging of financial aid to make sure we are pulling everything from apprenticeship, work study, combined with, you know, Pell Grants and state grants, combined with our scholarshiping. I mean, I think our number, Angela, last year was $55 million in scholarships that we provided to students. So we are always trying to make sure we're providing really strong supports for the students who need it. A good example are the ADTs. So there are these things called associate degree transfer programs in the state of California, which are associate degrees that have agreed upon transfer relationships where if they come in, they're automatically a junior. We're a participant in the ADT program for California and a big player in it. But if you're a low-income first-generation student coming from a community college on an ADT scholarship, because of our scholarships, it's basically free college because Pell Grant will cover your tuition all the way through. right? So for us, that affordability thing is a really big deal. So many of our students are, they're just wrestling with basic needs, housing insecurity, food insecurity, transportation issues. So we're trying to make sure we can wrap the right kind of supports around them to get them the right kind of resources. Emergency aid, for example, is almost as impactful as Pell Grants because the right support for those students really matters. And I go back to my own background. You know, I come from a family of 9 kids and we had 25 foster kids that rotated through when I was growing up. We always had about 2 at a time. So I have 4 kids, which my mom calls the starter family. But I think about like my own experience. If when I was going through Mason Community College, if my car broke down, like that might mean I might have to take a semester off because being paying for that was going to be that hard for me to be able to handle. I had no support from my extended family, no support for that. If my daughter's car broke down when she was in college, you know what that meant? She called dad. Right. And she got the support because she was scaffolded. And I'm glad, you know, I don't begrudge anybody that kind of support. It's just the realization, the percentage of low income, first generation, non-traditional students who need that kind of support. You got to be eyes on the prize about it because you want to make sure you're providing the right kind of financial really matters. But it's not just financial. It's other kinds of wraparounds as well that go with it.
Yeah, you hit on some really good points there. And I think too often in administration, we lose sight of what 15, 20, 25 bucks can mean to some of these students. I mean, that's a week worth of ramen noodles and food. And so if they have to pay for that breakdown or they have to pay for an emergency medical bill or something like that, that can really set these students back. And so keeping that open mind that all students aren't in the same position and to offer that financial flexibility and options for students is, it can truly be a lifesaver. So thanks for your thoughts there. Angela, let's jump to you. The S part of our Ascend model, which is support. How can universities and institutions best support students to help them achieve their educational goals and dreams?
Yeah, Eric, I'm going to touch on the personalization thread, which I know has come up multiple times here. Sarah talked about it quite a bit. It's through personalization, right, that we start to really do the best support for our students. And you know, universal supports are certainly important, right? They're foundational, but spray and pray models of student support are never going to help with increasingly diverse student populations, with the tremendous variety of needs and levels of preparation and life circumstances that our students come to us with. And so in order to really personalize and target student support, as Mark said, the right support to the right student at the right time, we have, I think, 3 core strategies that I'll touch on for doing the best level of support that we can provide. One, we've adopted the Loss of Momentum framework as our framework for student success. Loss of Momentum framework comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Completion by Design Initiative, some time ago. But really what it means for us is that we are taking a student-centric view of the progression through the student journey and the experiences. Sarah's talked about the moments that matter. And what we're doing is we're identifying, quantifying those opportunities to mitigate student loss and to build student momentum through every stage of the student journey. What underscores that in our ability to identify and be concrete about those opportunities are advanced analytics and predictive models, one. And those really help us identify certain bands of students who need a specific kind of support at the right time. And those analytics also help give us signals as to the underlying mechanisms that we need to address in order to facilitate the success for that student. The third leg of this tripod really is honestly Sarah's work on student experience. And for us to have real-time indicators, real-time measurements of student sentiment and of student friction, experience of friction throughout that journey so that we can engage with those students in real time and react and solve for problems and help improve that student experience and deliver value. So, you know, it's all about personalization. It's all about having both the student success framework and the underlying tool sets to support an increasingly personalized model at scale, because it's the scale part that's really tricky there.
Yeah, it is that scale part that's really tricky, right? We can all support a single student pretty well.
Yeah.
But not every single one of our students has a full-time staff member that just follows them around in a one-to-one relationship. Right. Yeah, that scale piece is interesting. I love the framework that you outlined there too. That's great stuff. All right, let's talk about the C part of the Ascend model, which is culture. And as you all know, building a culture that is focused on student success is really hard to do. And I imagine, particularly at an institution of your size, that can be challenging. So Mark, maybe we start right there at the top, because that's what usually people will say is it's got to start at the top. But the building the right culture can be challenging on a number of levels. So talk to us a little bit about how you go about creating the right culture on campus that's focused on student success.
Yeah, I think it's less about me and more about Dashley University's history and tradition of caring about student success. I mean, it is, if you go, you know, just the fact that our mission statement is focused on world-class student experiences and deeper learning, our vision is about being an inclusive and innovative university of basically difference makers, training difference makers. Like, it's in our blood. Like, we actually have adopted, and this was, you know, well over 1,000 people participating in this process, of developing what we call our ways of work. And our ways of work statement is at our best, like we as a university, if you're watching us do our thing, whether, and by the way, our board has adopted this, our leadership teams, it's how our governance bodies work. And we have them plastered on a wall everywhere. The idea is at our best, if you watch us work, you should see that we care about championing student success, about advancing inclusion, about building trust, about embracing accountability, and about, and I love our last one, make things better. And the make things better, we really chose that because a lot of places will choose innovation, right? Or something like that. But that doesn't make everybody feel like they belong, because not everybody's working on the big innovative things. And truthfully, make things better is a big innovation for sure. But it also is, hey, pick up the trash in the parking lot, fix the drop-down menu in the, on the website. Every little thing you do, it's the atomic habits, right? Every little thing you do adds up over time. So we have kind of built this culture where championing student success is first. It is the first ways of work. And everything else is in service of helping us champion student success. And that's not a throwaway line. It actually is. We literally have what's called waykeepers, who are people who look at our ways of work. And so we have, even at our board meetings, they have a report out on how do we keep with like focusing on these things. So that eye on the prize-ism is just, it's just ingrained in National University's culture. And the best thing for us is because so many people participated in pulling that together, it's not me trying to sell something, right? It's not, that's why I don't like the term buy-in, because it does sound like you're selling something. Like it is, this is who we want to be. Like they said that at their best aspiration, we want to be about this. And so we can kind of hold each other accountable to it, which is a really good thing. But you got to follow that up. Like people have to see that in your metrics. They have to see that in your operations. So, I mean, a good thing is we're literally having a conversation right now around the whole notion of we're growing really well right now. We're actually having significant, you know, double digit growth in undergraduate education in particular. It's like a 20-25% right now, but that's not the goal. Our goal, we talk about it all the time, we want to be good to grow. We want to deserve to grow. Like our whole idea is like we want to focus on working, and everybody has work to do. We always have work to do on making our classes better, on making our support better, on making our systems better. And we say out loud, our job right now is to be good to grow, is to really drive. Because if your target is growth, you're going to end up in goal displacement where you're going to pull all kinds of levers to optimize growth, and it's going to hurt the student experience. We want to actually focus on that student experience first. We want to focus on those kind of outcomes. And that's the cultural part of it. But those ways of work have become real anchors for us. And Angela, you might want to jump in on that one just for a second, because you were a part of the strategic plan group and that became kind of an anchor within the strat plan.
Oh, absolutely. The strat plan was such an inclusive process, right? We went through all levels of the organization. We had Miro boards online. We had the pillars of the strategic plan, and we had folks, you know, really digging in and providing their input as to how we're going to deliver on that strategic plan, and how, you know, what ideas did they have within the pillars? How are we going to connect the dots? Thousands of inputs from across the institution into how we do that, just like we did with the way of work. I think it really has been just a terrific ground up, a very inclusive cultural process.
I love what you're saying, and more importantly, the focus on championing and putting students first. I think too often institutions, that rolls off our tongues pretty easy, but having the, what did you call them, the waykeepers on the back end and some of these other mechanisms in place to actually hold yourselves accountable for doing what you say you're going to do. And I think too many other institutions, it's the tail wagging the dog that Perhaps we're putting faculty and our needs first, or staff or administration, or trying to make jobs easier, as opposed to really making sure students are first in everything that we do. So kudos to you all and holding yourselves accountable and finding a way to do that, because that's really impressive in this day and age. So
Eric, something you'll love is we actually just did a community hall a little over a month ago, or a couple months ago, where we focused specifically on this notion of get grounded, get real, get going. And the idea of get grounded is get clear about your mission, vision, strategic plan, and direction. But that's all wonderful. You got to get real, which is you got to turn the lights on and you got to ask hard questions and face hard data. And we talked about the way we do that. We don't want to have a culture of blame. We want to have a culture of wonder. We want to lean into it and figure out how we can get better. And you get grounded, you get real. Get real is the hard part, because that's when you really have to realize, hey, we're not good at this. We got to work on this. And then you got to get going, which is try, tune, test. So Sarah can speak to this. It was a big part of our work on student experience and on getting to an MPS score, and like really kind of driving that is being willing to ask those hard questions and then get after the work. And it was a wonderful kind of cultural moment for our university to say, it's okay that we're not good in these areas. We got to get better. It's just get real right now and kind of drive onto it.
That get real aspect, Sarah, do you want to jump in there? But that get real aspect, I can see causing a lot of heartburn on many campuses, right?
Yeah, I think it's done in a way at the national team where we collectively own the student experience. It's not, one person charging up the mountain to get the flag up there up first. It's all of us, collectively owning through the ways that are working, but also really understanding what is the current student experience. What is it today? What is it this week? What is it this month? How are we trending? How are we tracking? And like Mark says, being real about what those results are, both all the wins, because there's wins there. We should be celebrating those. There are people affecting students through support, through learning every day. And students are walking away saying, that was a moment that really mattered to me. That really changed my view on this paper, my view on my education, and they have an impact. We have to celebrate that. That is so fundamental to why we come to the table. But then there are moments of maybe friction, opportunity, where we didn't hit it quite right. But we have to face what those are. But to be able to do that, you need an ecosystem of experience to understand that. And I think that is what is going to make national different, is that we have that ecosystem built so that we can understand the experiences of those moments and understand where we are having that momentum, like Angela talked about, and so that we can dig in and say, hey, listen, this didn't strike right. We need to go back and we need to re-engineer this, like Mark was saying.
Y'all are doing some amazing things. That's awesome. Thanks for that. Sarah, let's stay on you and jump to the E part of the Ascend model, which is engagement. What are tips you'd like to share to our listeners about ways to increase student engagement?
I think we have talked a lot about personalization and the experience ecosystem, but I want to be a little bit more crystal clear about what that is. Mark said about the MPS score. Who would promote their learning today? Who would promote their learning to a friend or colleague this week, this month, this year, and talk about national? I often joke that for me, I have upper elementary age children, and so I spend a little bit of time at the bus stop every day. And so when you're at the bus stop, who would you tell about your current experience at national? And what would you say? What would those pieces that you would tell a friend or colleague? And understanding those pieces, we've been able to use sentiment to really understand not just the words our students are using, but understanding where is it neutral, where is it positive, where is it trending, with opportunity, and how do we understand those words in the student's language? I think too often when we think about experience, we think about that survey bubble, and it's really in our language. But at National, we've been able to kind of work our way outside that survey bubble and really get true to the student's voice. And when you do that, it allows you to understand the engagement from their eyes. And that really does translate to changing how you develop different strategies. And, I think the student engagement boils down to kind of three key aspects. It's how are we interacting with our students? Is it real time? Is it engaging? Does it really give that value that they're looking for? And is it personalized enough where every person can get what they want from it? And then, do we have a supportive learning community? Is there a place to go if I need childcare? Is there someone I can talk to when I'm struggling? Is there a place I can celebrate my wins? Where is the support aspect of that? And then really, where do the technology enriched pieces, you know, is this something I can really pull up easily and accomplish? Do I know where I'm headed? Is the technology being my partner so that I can ensure achieve my learning aspects? But then understanding the interplay into my experience and ensuring that we understand what those experiences are real time so that we can pivot quicker. And I think the students expect that from their engagement. They really want to achieve their goals. They have a dream of their future selves, and we want to be their partner in that. But that does take a very intentionality in each experience so that we can answer that call every day.
Yes, thank you. All right, let's move on to the N, which is nudges. So Sarah or Angela, either one of you, how are you using nudges there at National University to help students stay on this path to completion and achieving their goals and dreams?
Yeah, I'll jump in on that. I think we're at the beginning of formalizing our nudging strategy because we've been focused on building our student engagement ecosystem, as Sarah was talking about, and our advanced analytics and predictive analytics. Those are the things that are going to help us identify the students who will benefit from a nudge. We have to be very careful not to oversaturate our students with communications. That in itself can be stigmatizing or a negative experience. You need to communicate what matters when it matters. To the right students. And so we'll be using those that data-informed model of identifying our opportunities for nudging. In some cases, it'll be just a general positive supportive nudge. Hey, how are you doing? The check-in, right? The non-stigmatizing check-in. In other cases, we will know that there's a need for a clear positive call for action to support a student in a next best action. And so we're building up all of the data that we need, as well as the community of care, the system of care that will engage to support and be there to support those students once those nudges are deployed.
All right, let's jump to the D part of the Ascend model, and Mark or Angela jump in here. How are you using data to inform your work related to student success, or what would you recommend to institutions as better ways to use their data?
Again, I'll go back to the get grounded, get real, get going. We've made a commitment to really doing the blocking and tackling to build a data infrastructure for our future. And it's been tough work because National University over the last 3 years has been going through a merger and pulling multiple universities together into one big university, which is National. And so we're integrating multiple data systems as we're pulling it together. We're getting a lot better at it, but Angela knows my own predilection for data and my own feelings about democratizing that data. Because we really want our faculty and staff to be student success scientists with us. We're trying to turn the lights on bright and making sure we're all asking and answering questions as student success scientists, right? Trying to understand the right supports at the right time for the right kinds of students. So we're deeply committed to one, the really work, doing the work to create a quality data system that then can be leveraged to democratize your data as effectively as possible. And part of that democratization, by the way, is getting the data to students. Students should be active participants in this process and understanding where they are and where they're going. We want to change the game so that students will be able to say, a student like me at this stage, here's the next set of courses I should take. Here's the next direction. Here's the next experience I should engage in. And those kinds of like just reality therapy kind of recommendation engines would be super useful. Not to mention data on like, here are the people you should be connecting with, the experiences you should be trying to engage. Again, we want them to have a value-rich experience. We should be coaching them and nudging them and guiding them. That's going to be anchored in data. And then the other side of it. So you're going to use data for care and for enrichment in really clear ways. And then you're also going to use it for accountability. Totally get you got to use it for accountability. Most universities are lopsided. They do almost all their work on accountability and hardly enough on care. Like, we want to be a balanced university that is doing the accountability work in a really clear way. We understand our grad rates, our persistence rates. We understand we have a whole series of kind of indicators that Angela can walk you through. But we really want to get that data in the hands of people who are on the front lines. And I think far too many universities infantilize their faculty. They try to tell them what they should be doing as opposed to, you know, they're trained professionals who are wildly successful at what they do. If they had the data, they would be willing to jump into it and probably do a lot more. And I think what we want to be able to do is get them the infrastructure so they can be able to pull that together.
Yeah, good stuff. Angela, any additional thoughts on how you're using data? This is kind of your world, you know, on a day-to-day basis. How else are you using data?
I mean, Mark really covered the breadth of it, right? We are working hard to merge the data from the institutions that have come together to make National today. And as we deploy that new merged data, we're just thinking very clearly with our audience in mind. It's not just let's publish a bunch of data and democratize it and set it all free. It's to what end? It's to what questions can we answer? What problems can we solve? How can we inform action for everybody out there, from students to faculty and staff? Then the other thing that I'll point out is, you know, is us all marching to the same beat. And so we've put into place monthly and quarterly operating reviews that have a core set of metrics to them. And, you know, for every operational and academic unit on campus, we are all reporting monthly on the same stuff. And we are having important, I think, cross-functional collaborative conversations about those metrics and how do we collectively solve for them. Because if one unit is struggling with something, it's not just theirs, right? It is a collective solutioning conversation. So I think that's the other key part is the unification in that accountability space that turns into a collective problem solving space.
Yeah, those MORs and QORs have been transformative for the university because they start the conversations. And by the way, they are anchored in three sets of data. One is your student success data, like how are your students doing and everything. So every single month we're looking, how are the students progressing? What are the big challenges? What are the things we're looking at? And at quarterly, we do an even deeper dive. And then we're looking at financial and sustainability data. And then we're looking at strategy, which is, are you on track to hit your strategic goals, the kind of things you're looking at? And the fact we call that question every month and we have a deeper dive every quarter, and it is totally based on the conversation about how we get better. It is to make things better in action. It really does help. In a big way. And what's funny is Sarah gets called on a lot because they want to hear the student voice of this. They want to hear like, what are the students actually saying about this? What are the sentiments out of it? And it's really interesting how you end up with this combination of, I call it the three Ds, right? Which is data science, design thinking, and domain expertise. That's really the magic kind of like combo. If you can get good data combined with really good design thinking together with really good domain expertise, that's when, you know, you can start putting things together that can be transformative.
I think the partnership that we have between student experience and institutional research, where that partnership doesn't really exist in a lot of other places. And so I think that really has made the data become more relevant because we can have these active conversations between institutional research and student experience and say, hey, I have this piece over here I can bring to your table. And Angela does the same thing back to my table. And we've created this partnership that really is allowing us to not only understand the student voice, but really bring it to the forefront of making better strategic decisions every day. And through those QORs and MOR process, that has even become more tightly aligned.
Oh, wow. Such good stuff. I love it. I love what you're doing there. Thanks for sharing with our listeners. All right. So one final question for each of you. If you could go back in time and provide some advice to your younger self to help you be more effective in your work, what would that piece of advice be? Sarah, we're starting with you.
All right. For me, I really thought about this question. It was a real thought provoker for me. I went to medicine for a very traditional set of pathway for my career. It was you go to healthcare administration and then you work through operations and this is what you do. So I really took a chance on experience work. That was not very well defined in medicine when I took that role. It was a very first of its kind. And so my advice to my younger self would be to take more chances on the non-traditional path. There are journeys that you take and chances you take with, I think, well-decided information, but that really can open yourself up to a different way of thinking about your work. And as you're deciding what you want to be when you grow up, to kind of go with what's going to enrich your soul and who you are as a person and the way you play best on the team. And that role will start to come to fruition. If you had said that I would be looking at unsolicited data models to impact the student experience ecosystem to my younger self, I can honestly say that person would have said, I'm sorry, you're going to what? So I think there's an openness that I have really allowed myself to have that was great. I had a lot of great mentors that said, listen, you're really great and a really great passionate leader about the mission. How can you bring that to more people? And that to me was through the experience work and just having that open mind of, you know, you may have a picture of yourself today, but being a little bit open-minded to different roles that come across your desk or your path to really make your way you play on the team. It's a wholly different journey. And so I guess to me it's openness about who you could be.
Good advice. All right, Angela, we're coming to you next.
I'm going to talk specifically to the introverts of higher education. And it's germane specifically in the world of data, because a lot of people drawn to the work of data and analysis, right, are introverts, and they like to be head down and they like to get into the weeds with the numbers. But I'm a turning point for me in my career was early in my administration side of my career, when a senior administrator wrote in a 360 review that Angela needs to find her voice. And I knew lots of things, right? I watched the data, I analyzed the data, I thought about what it meant, I wrote the reports for everyone, but I needed to find my voice at the table and be confident in what I had to contribute. And so my advice to the introverts of higher education is not to be afraid to engage. You've got to engage. You've got to speak up. You've got to ask questions, learn more, and step in and volunteer to take some ownership, because we need the voices. We need the diversity of voices and perspectives in order to do our solutioning well, because in many ways, right, we represent the same students that we serve. And so we need that diversity of voices, and we need the introverts to articulate.
I love that, right? I know, as a fellow introvert, I just love that advice. And for me, Susan Cain's book on introversion was so life-changing for me to find my voice and to discover that introverts play such an incredibly important role in leadership.
They do.
So I love that.
And it really can, leadership in particular can be a cult of extroversion. Extroversion can be explicitly rewarded in leadership. And so, you know, the leaders of the world too, I think, are becoming better. I've seen over time a real shift there in valuing and bringing out the introverts at the table, which adds to the strength.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah. Very good. All right, President, let's finish with you.
I would tell myself, you know, when you look back on your career from a later vantage, the things you tend to focus on are the people you've met, just the variety of unbelievable folks you've had the pleasure of meeting with, and sometimes the people that who've been really hard in your lives, the experiences you've had, the lessons you've learned, and the difference you've made. And the hard truth is, when you look back on it and you reflect on it, that stuff's going to happen to you whether you like it or not. You're going to be interacting with people because you're in situations. You're going to be having experiences because of what's happening with a job you're in or whatever it is. And you're going to be learning things because you have to or you're forced to. And you're going to be also making differences whether you like it or not. You can either make a positive difference or a negative difference depending on what you're doing. What I would tell myself is it's okay to be intentional about that and start curating now, which is get clear about who do you want to meet and why, who do you want to be around? Because those people change your lives. If you can get around those people, learn from those mentors and soak it up with an empty cup, boy, is it useful. Have those experiences, go try something and learn and grow and develop from that experience. Really lean into learning something new. It's okay. You want to be a rookie every year. Try something that takes you out of your comfort zone. It's going to be super helpful for you. The brain research says it's one of the things that keeps you out of dementia when you get older. And then the last thing is get very focused on the difference you want to make. Like, get clear and just get after it. Because if you want to make that difference, you can start doing it now and then build towards something into the future if you're going to do it. So again, my idea is, like, that stuff might happen to you whether you like it or not. You'd rather be intentional about it. So just start with doing the work now.
Well, fantastic insight and advice and recommendations, not only with that last question, but throughout the podcast. So thank you all so much for being with us today, Mark, Angela, and Sarah. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you three. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Good show. We've loved every bit of it.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. And thanks again to our listeners as well for joining us. We will be back soon with another expert session. See you later.
You've been listening to the Ascend Podcast. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, we hope you'll give us a like on your preferred listening platform and leave us a review. We also would invite you to connect with us on LinkedIn by simply searching for us, Jared Tippetts and Eric Kirby, where we would love to continue discussing today's topic with you.
And for more practical and proven strategies, just like the one you learned about today, check out our book, Ascend to Higher Retention Rates, Practical Strategies for Increasing Student Retention, Completion, and Student Success, which can be purchased on Amazon.com or on our website, www.tippettskirby.com.
We'll be back again soon with another podcast. Until then, keep on raging.